Season 1, Episode 1. Today's guest, the Electric Spirit Company. But now let's get started with the most juniper-loaded show on the interwebs.
It's the Fabulous Gin Show. Jan Persiel.
Welcome to the Fabulous Gin Show. This is the first episode and I could not be happier that this podcast is out in the open now. All the information is on the website gin.show, so if you need anything, head over there. We will dig deep into all things gin, be it distillation, botanicals, marketing and design, as well as financial aspects. We start the show with an interview with a fine gentleman from Leith in Scotland, James Portuous, the founder of the Electric Spirit Company. Today we have a guest from way up north, and it's James. And is it Portuous, or how do you pronounce it?
Oh, that's bang on. Well done.
First time lucky. Great. Wonderful. And we are talking about, well, probably not your... Is it your main profession? You've got different professions from what I've learned so far. So you've basically switched or at least extended what you're doing for a living. But maybe first of all, we should talk about where you come from and why I am talking to you. Why are you on the Fabulous Gin Show? So there must be some connection to gin, I guess.
You know, I'd hope so. Yeah, I think we're probably on to something
there. Let's see. Hopefully I got the right James there. Great. Okay, so you're from way up north, I said. Maybe just give us a quick location beacon where we could find you and who you are in a few words, basically.
Okay, so I'm James. I'm the owner and distiller and tea boy and delivery guy at Electric Spirit Company. And that's a distillery based up in Edinburgh in Scotland. I've lived in Scotland for most of my life. I lived in London for a little bit. I've had a few different careers so far. I'm full time on the gin now. That sounds quite bad, but yeah, I'm a full-time distiller these days. So it's everything I do is relating to gin at the moment. So that's where I am just now. I've been producing gin in Edinburgh since 2015. So
great. And your previous occupation, at least from what I read on, I don't know, some website, I think it was... where was it? Doesn't matter. That could be it, right? Yeah. That you've been a designer before, a product designer, is it right?
When I was I left school and my undergraduate degree was in product design at the Glasgow School of Art. So I did that, and I worked for 3 years as a designer, and I moved to London. Because that's what you do in Britain when you're a designer, you move to London. And it was great, and I had a great time. And then I was down there, and I just kind of, the type of design that I did was quite niche. It's called service design. You don't really need to know what that is, just know that it's quite kind of close to being a management consultant. And I didn't really enjoy that because I went to art school. So basically, I kind of started looking around at things that I'd potentially like to do instead. And at that point I was thinking I'd like to move back to Scotland. And I knew that I didn't want to do what I was doing at the moment. So I kind of, I'd always been kind of into craft brewing, like those little breweries that were popping up at that time around London, places like Colonel and Beavertown were just really small at that point. And I kind of thought, oh man, that'd be a cool thing to do up in Edinburgh. So I thought, well, there's a brewing distilling course at Heriot Watt, which is a university just kind of on the outskirts of Edinburgh, and it's quite well known in the industry. There's a lot of distilleries and breweries there. They're kind of their head guys and guys in production or stuff have studied there. So I basically kind of looked into, I didn't think I'd be able to go there because it was the requirements were very kind of science-based degrees. And I threw them an email and said, look, I'd really like to do this course. I've been working in a totally different industry for 3 years. And they were like, yeah, sure. If you think you can do it, then we're fine with you coming on board. So I quit my job in London and I moved back to Scotland. Before I did that, actually, I did a couple of weeks work experience at Beavertown in London, on the brewery side of things, just kind of helping them with brews, carrying malt sacks around, and just getting a kind of feel for what it's like to work in a commercial brewery. And obviously we're talking about brewing here, which is a bit strange considering we were meant to be talking about gin. But over the course of the distilling course at Heriot Watt, I realized that the distilling side of things is something I'd never had any experience of, and I just found it very interesting. So I decided that instead of trying to open a brew pub, which was the idea that I would have in the first place, I would try and put together a little tiny micro distillery and start making gin. And yeah, that all took, I graduated in 2013, and it took me about a full year to figure out all the bits and pieces of starting a tiny gin distillery effectively. So it was, that's kind of where the design side went from and where it got to. But yeah, and it's that point I kind of started Electric Spirit Company in Leith in Edinburgh. So.
And maybe we start with the obvious. Where does the Electric Spirit Company part, the naming part, come from? I mean, on this podcast here, it's hard to show your bottle, though. I might just refer to our show cover, and we'll have the bottle on there. Despite the fact that it's probably hard to really bring across the bottle because it's it's such a vibrant bottle. Depending on how the light hits the bottle, it really glows up. And the more UV light hits it, the more it starts glowing, really, without having to add any really artificial lighting. Also, and again, the camera is really struggling to capture it.
I was going
to
say it's a nightmare to take a picture of, and even from getting product photographers to do photos of it, they're like, it's so annoying to take pictures of because it's so bright, and the contrast between the label, well, the text on the bottle and the color of the bottle is so absolute. It's very very hard to take pictures of. I didn't really think about that when I came up with the design, but the electric.
It's your revenge to the design community. Yeah, there you go, suckers.
Yeah, it's like a designer in control is not necessarily a good thing. But yeah, the name is kind of, it's a bit of an odd one. So I mean, if you're able to have a look at the bottle, so the big thing on the front of it is the light bulb logo. And that came about as just kind of it's like the almost a cartoon idea of like when a cartoon character has an idea, they have a light bulb above their head. And I just kind of fiddled around with that and was like literally scribbling on pieces of paper and kind of came up with the kind of the bottle and the bulb kind of thing. And then weirdly, at that point, I didn't actually have, the company didn't have a name. So I just worked back from that, and electric seemed like a fairly obvious choice, not just because of the link to kind of light and obviously the kind of electricity side of things, but the kind of associations with sort of vibrancy and kind of sort of like standing out and illuminating. And I really wanted electric to be doing something that wasn't just the same as every other company out there. And that kind of fitted very well. And then the name of the gin is the other bit. So aqueous comes from achromatic, so meaning without color. And because it's got ach and oo in it, everyone thinks it's a Scottish word, just because when a Scotsman says those kind of those noises, you just sound like you're wearing a kilt no matter what you're doing. It actually comes from ancient Greek, so it's kind of an odd one. And it means, because it means colorless, it's basically me kind of taking the piss a little bit. It's just a bit of silly fun. But I actually didn't, it got to the point where the gin was finished and I had the first batch of bottles. In fact, a lot of batches of bottles were all hand stamped with like a little Christmas card stamp that I had made. And I had the bottles, they were ready to go. And then I realized I hadn't actually named the gin. So initial idea was to name, for the company to have gins named or products named in kind of alphabetical, like A, B, C, D, E, F, G, kind of like, sort of tropical storms and things. And then I realized that, well, just when I was about to do that, there was a really bad hurricane in America, and I thought it would be in quite bad taste. So I kind of looked, I was like, okay, let's think of something different. And literally went through kind of Googling like cool words beginning with A. and then that one just leapt out as like perfect. It was just kind of this happy kind of coincidence of beginning with A and also fitting the kind of me being a bit cheeky kind of thing quite well. So yeah, that was where the name for the gin came from. Although it's been mispronounced to a spectacular degree by everyone, including myself. So it was learnings from the first product of Electric Spirit Company are don't use names that are quite hard to spell or say or search for on Google. But a lot of people just give up and call it the Electric Gin. So it's quite a reasonable one to have in terms of a fallback. People kind of recognize the bottle, and like you say, it does tend to stand out, so people kind of know if a bar has it.
Totally. And I must say, when I looked it up, because I wasn't quite sure, I had like Latin and Greek in school, so there were some bits and pieces which kind of like reminded me a bit of it. And when I looked it up, the and was reaffirmed, and I actually had to laugh, because with that bottle and then this tagline or this name for the gin was just really the you couldn't get more diametrically opposed parts. Yeah, between the design and the name.
Yeah, it's just a bit of daft fun, really, from my perspective. But yeah, it's the practical thing of people not knowing how to say it. It's kind of annoying, but...
Yeah, it actually had on my search on Google, I think there were like 3 YouTube recommendations saying how to pronounce it properly, yeah. Right? So it's like, all right, okay, there's an issue there.
Yeah, I need to, I'm currently reading the company website, and I need to actually have a bit on it. It's like, okay, how do you actually pronounce this product so people can actually order it rather than kind of just sort of pointing at it and going, the orange one. I mean, that's fine. If they buy it, it's great.
Yeah. Yes, I think we had that in our first chat, isn't it? I mean, if it gets to the level where these old tango spots or commercials go, yeah. Then it kind of hits the same level of being memorable for sure.
Yeah, right. Definitely.
As all the others, I've wrestled with the bottle as well, but I'll shoot you the image. Actually, I gave up on it, really, and I thought, all right, okay, if you're making my life hard, I'll throw everything at it that I have. And let us just say we'll use the one for the podcast cover, and you'll see it very soon. Great. Okay. Well. So that gives us a little bit of a background where you come from, and this is not something where you've been born into a distiller's tradition for generations and generations, but actually picked something up which kind of drew you towards it and which felt good. And you've changed basically doing that full time now, and from what I saw, you're basically doing that from the micro distillery right now, and there are some actually it said, I think, on the gin cooperative as well, that it's basically more or less a shared space right now. And I while looking around before our chat, I figured that it's actually that there's another product which because I when I saw that basically the location, I was actually wondering, oh, okay, near the port, there's another one, which I just had recently on my desk, basically, to try it, which was the Linden Lime. And then I was actually wondering whether there's a kind of an overlap, and there seems to be as well, right? So
yeah, so... to go back a little bit, so when I started Electric Spirit Company, I was trying to find like the smallest premises possible that I could put a gin distillery in. And I found that actually you could start a gin distillery technically in a lot of offices in Scotland because of the way the kind of the planning permissions and work. But that's fine in theory, but going to someone and saying, hi, I'd like to hire this office space. Oh, sure, what are you going to use it for? I'd like to boil ethanol in it. they tend to get a little bit tense when you start talking about that kind of activity. They'd rather have a nice accountant or a lawyer in there paying the rent. So I went round and round and round in circles for ages. And I realized that whilst I could do that in the middle of Edinburgh, it just wasn't going to work. So I looked at Leith, which is in Edinburgh, the kind of historic port area. It's still a working port now. I mean, if you go down to the water, you'll see there's currently at the moment a huge number of ships all in port because they're not being used. But Leith historically has been filled with bonded warehouses. There's been whiskey distilleries, all kinds of kind of alcohol and trade related. There's a massive glassworks as well, which produced a lot of bottles down there, specifically for the drinks industry. And it has been redeveloped massively over the years. So there's very little of that left. And annoyingly, all these buildings that were purpose built for distilling have been turned into offices and turned into apartments. So it's quite frustrating, but I managed to find a tiny little part of an industrial unit, which was an old lemonade factory. I mean, it's the most hipster building I could have possibly found in terms of wanting to start a gin distillery is an old lemonade factory in a port area. It's like someone has written a comic about making gin. And I found this tiny little room, and it's the size of a very small kitchen, and it was perfect, and it cost very little money, and it was just big enough, and it had everything I needed, and it was the perfect size, and it allowed me to start on a little 10-liter still, so absolutely tiny, about the size of a football, and that very quickly increased to 20 liters, and then for the first while I was producing on this little 20-liter still, doing 5 distillations into to make one batch of gin, which was like 130-140 bottles, very very small amounts. And at that, and then towards a while ago, then these two guys who are Paddy and Ian of the Port of Leith Distillery, which at that point was just a glimmer in their eyes, approached me and said, like, "Oh, hey, we're planning to open a whiskey distillery, and we just wanted to say hello, and yeah, it'd be cool if we could figure out a way to kind of." Do something together in the future in some way. And I was like, yeah, fine, whatever, that sounds interesting. And then we talked more, and effectively the long story short was that they needed someone to come and help them develop they're building this beautiful whiskey distillery beside this big shopping center called Ocean Terminal, which has the Royal Yacht Britannia mirrored alongside it. And in the run-up to that, they were kind of very interested in producing a gin, and I suggested that I would be able to help them create this secondary kind of distilling site so we could spec it all out, get it ready for production. And I would work with them to develop the recipe that they had ideas about. And then I would, as part of that, I would move in and I would produce my gin there, and we would share this production site. So yeah, that's how it's been going for the last I think, two odd years now. I've been producing for that kind of length of time. They launched Linden Lime last Christmas. Get my years mixed up now. I feel like lockdown's completely broken my mind in terms of working out timings, but
yeah, not just for you, I think.
Yeah, so we now have this production site, and it's called the Tower Street Stillhouse. It's right by, it's literally the outside our distillery, there's the port wall is against the side of the building, so we're literally just outside the boundary of the port. And like, you come and park the car in the morning and you look over the wall, and there's quite often a mast sticking up from an oil rig supply vessel or a pipe laying huge ship that kind of going sailing across the Atlantic. But yeah, it's we have this shared site, and it's worked out really well, particularly I think for as a small distilling company. The Port Leith guys are way ahead of me in terms of production and kind of getting their product out there, and they're a bigger business, and like for me to be able to work with a bigger business to kind of help mine is great. And I think the most important bit is we all get on really well, because I think that's the initial thing, is when you move into a flat with someone to live with them, you think like, oh, it's a great flat, and then you really hope that the person you're moving in with is good. But yeah, we get on really well, and we take the piss out of each other relentlessly, but we do all we can to kind of help each other out in terms of doing deliveries and kind of doing events and things. So it's nice to have a company that on the outside you would kind of view as like, well, you're working with your competition. How can you do that? And it's like, well, it's not. There's a very kind of cooperative relationship we have, and I don't know of any other companies that are doing it to the level that we are doing it in terms of running these two businesses so close side by side. It's funny. Everyone's like gets confused when they're like, oh, but there's your address is the same as this other distillery. And I was like, yeah, it's the same. It's the same place, but two very different companies. So it's good for that.
Perfect. Well, to be honest with you, it's something where I think one can see that even you know, if you work with them on the first recipes or recipe, then it basically shows that there's more to just distilling it, right? And as you say, they might be ahead in terms of distribution or whatever, and it's totally different products, really. Yeah. To some extent, but that, yeah, it's not just about getting the stuff distilled and just filling a couple of bottles and just shipping it out there, right? There's a lot more to it, and probably, I mean, as you said, even for this first gin, just regarding the name and the bottle, there's so much to be learned and so much to be shared, and that's probably how you, well, big words, but probably how you can divide mankind, basically, the one half who thinks no, you need to keep everything to yourself, otherwise other people might steal your ideas, or those who think sharing is actually giving something away, which very often comes back two or three or whatever fold, right?
So I think it's exactly that. It's the idea that there's no point in two companies making the same mistakes. And when there's been things early on when I've experienced things about the industry that I then kind of am able to say, like, oh, just so you know, this happened to me when I did that. And then equally now, because of how far that the Port Relief Distillery and Linden Lime as a product has come on in terms of the things I'm learning from working with in the same place as the Port Relief guys, it's hugely beneficial. And I really, really value the fact that I'm able to kind of learn from a much bigger company who's really kind of powering ahead. And yeah, I think the reality with gin production as well is, from being involved in the development of both these products, I could spend a day with the botanicals that are in my gin, for example, and come up with six gins that taste completely different from each other, completely different approaches, completely different styles, just because in the same way that if you gave someone the ingredients for a cake, it's going to yield completely different results depending on how you mix them together. So I think the good thing about gin is there's not really, as long as you're aware of the kind of ideas that you're kind of interested in having, or the flavors and the aromas you're interested in having in your product, it's very simple to make sure you have very distinct products. And I think that was, when we were working together, there's no real issue with that ever happening. So we have two very, very, I mean, we talked about being diametrically opposed in terms of the colors in my bottle, but in terms of the two products that we have being produced in the same distillery, you couldn't have two products that are more different from each other. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's no animosity. We work really well together, is because we're both doing very different things. So yeah, it's worked well in that respect too. So, and from my perspective, it's just nice to have other people around, because generally, like before, I was in my old site and I was just sitting on my own all the time. It was quite weird when moving into this new site, and Ian, one of the directors from Port Relief, was, I think, getting pretty fed up with how much I just talked all the time, because I wasn't used to having someone else in the distillery to talk to, especially when I talk about my cats, because Ian hates cats. And I have two of them, as you saw when we were setting up this call. So yeah, I think he was getting pretty fed up with me showing him pictures of cats, which is fair enough. So it's fine. But we've got past that, and I don't show him any cats anymore. And the businesses are at peace.
Fine. Yeah. Actually, I can just attest to that, because even though you might read that, I mean, they having pink peppercorns, I think it is, and you having Sichuan pepper. That might be pretty much the only thing having that word pepper in it, which is similar. And but yes, as you say, these are entirely different gins, not just from the outside, but from the taste. So maybe that's a good segue to move over to the gin itself. It's a friend of mine said a couple of days ago that he has actually moved on from having any expectations when he gets a bottle. And I think that's a plain lie, because you can't switch off certain things. But I somehow didn't expect the gin that I tasted when I got your gin compared to what the bottle kind of said. Don't ask me what I did expect. It certainly was something vibrant, but and probably more citrus or something like that, probably because of the orange. That's the most obvious thing. But the fennel part, which is in there, and the choice of botanicals is something you might want to talk about, is something which I simply did not expect. And actually it's probably something which makes people either love the product or probably hate it as well, because fennel and aniseed are very often flavors very which so people,
I think it's it's a fairly short botanical bill. It's not kind of going in for a kind of huge long list of kind of obscure ingredients. There's five core botanicals, I would say, that are fairly kind of standard gin botanicals. You've got juniper, coriander seed, orris root, liquor root, and angelica root. I think particularly on those, the one thing that I was very, very keen on was making sure that it had a lot of juniper in it, because I think there's been an overriding trend amongst gin to kind of drift away from having that kind of classic bitterness, the stringency that you, the resinous kind of flavor you get from juniper, because it's one of the hardest things to get into. If you're not a big fan of gin, then your first gin is probably going to be something a lot lighter and a lot more a lot kind of more delicate in terms of the juniper content. But I wanted something that had that big kind of chewy resinous kind of, you finish a gin and tonic and you still feel thirsty as a result of that kind of that quantity of juniper. So there's a lot of juniper in there. Coriander seed, fairly standard, but amongst the three roots that are in there, the orris, the licorice, and angelica root, I put in quite a lot of angelica root because it gives a nice kind of earthy, woody character to it, and makes it quite a kind of quite a rich feeling spirit to drink. And the two more unusual botanicals, I've touched on both of them briefly, but the so the first one is fennel seed, and fennel seed is in there because I love cooking with fennel seed. I think it's this beautiful, aromatic little seed, and it, unfortunately, in drinks, as you mentioned, has had a bit of a mixed history in terms of things it has been involved in. So things like Sambuca and Aftershock and various things that have lots and lots of aniseed flavor in them. And people have been brought those on a tray and when late at night when they don't want them by friends when they're out drinking, and as a result it colors people against them. So it's quite a tricky one, but I think the flavor is really, it works really well in a gin as long as you don't go nuts with it. I mean, the first trial batches of this gin were like, I put in what I thought was a reasonable amount and then it was just, it tasted like a bottle of ouzo, because you just, this aniseed flavor is so powerful and it just overwhelms everything. So
yes.
Yeah, I think I worked back like probably a dozen times with the amount and just keep taking it down till I got to the point where I was like, yeah, okay, cool. You get the flavor, but you also get everything else that's going on in the spirit too. So yeah, it was a funny one to work with because I had no idea it was such a potent ingredient. And even now when we're doing much bigger production runs, so the still size now, then the current distillery is 500 liters. So it's a lot bigger than the 20 liter one that I was doing the majority of the work on before that. And then even when you're scaling up, you're always aware that I probably am not going to multiply this up by as much as everything else because of this ingredient having this huge power in terms of flavor and aroma. So it's surprising how little fennel seed you need to make to give it that fennel flavor. And then the last one is Sichuan peppercorn. Sichuan peppercorn, is a bizarre little thing. It's not even technically a peppercorn. It's and if you see it, it looks like this dried, sad little kind of husk. But the flavor it has and the aroma it has is incredible. The first time I ever really tasted one on its own was I was in the pub waiting for a friend of mine to come back from this Edinburgh has this science festival every year. And he went to an event that was about flavor perception. So it was about when we say something tastes lemony, the reason we say lemony is because that's our frame of reference. So we, like, everyone knows what a lemon tastes like. It's the most common time you will have that flavor experience in your mouth. And they were basically going through really common flavors and saying, okay, well, this is something you would not expect to get this flavor from. And with the Szechuan peppercorns, he came back from this event and into the pub, and he was like, right, put one of these on your tongue. And I was like, sure. Put it on my tongue. I was like, wow, it's got this kind of numbing, tingling sensation. And it's like, it's so citrusy. Like it's like sherbet lemons. So like almost fizzy. And he's like, right, take it out and then drink your beer. And I was like, whoa, it's the flavor from the peppercorn is still there, and it's still kind of like influencing my beer. And I was like, it's an incredible little ingredient. And I mean, like, two beers later, all I could taste was this lemony sort of spice flavor. And I was less enthusiastic by that point because I just wanted my beer to taste like beer again. But the peppercorn itself, I was like, this is something I really want to try working with in terms of distillation. And played around with it a bit just on its own, actually, in a single botanical distillate to see what the actual flavors were coming through when you distill with it. And so much of it transfers over. It's really incredible. Like a lot of the ingredients, when you distill with them, beforehand you'll smell them, be like, oh, it smells incredible, and then you distill them, and then just the process of distilling it actually breaks down a lot of the kind of flavor and aroma compounds that are in there, and you lose a lot of things. But with peppercorns, it was like, it's all there. It's all got the flavor. It's still got the aroma. It's got this really rich, woody, floral kind of aroma, and then this beautiful, bizarrely citrusy note on the tongue. So I was like, yeah, this is the perfect ingredient for gin. And yeah, it's just a really nice one to work with, because I'm not using any other citrus in the botanical, so it's just a way of getting a slight kind of freshness to balance out the kind of the mustiness, the woodiness of the kind of root ingredients, and then also that big resinous kind of quality from the juniper berries as well. So yeah, and it's just also when you add tonic, this huge wafting aroma get from specifically from the peppercorns, I think it's incredible. It's just a lovely kind of thing to stick your nose into. But yeah, it's a kind of concise botanical bill. I kind of really wanted, with the gins that I work on, the main thing is not to just have a bunch of stuff in there for the sake of marketing. It's saying like, okay, cool, I want to pick a couple of really interesting ingredients that I think work well together, and then try and bring those out specifically in the gin, so you get the qualities of them. And at the end of the day, it's still got to work in a gin and tonic, and it's still got to work in a Negroni, and it's still got to work in a martini. So those are the kind of the red lines that I need to kind of meet every time. So those are the things that I look for in a gin. So that's kind of the story of the botanicals, effectively.
It basically adds a little bit more depth to the whole thing, right, than just some lemon peel. That's my feeling, not knowing all the separate distillation results, basically. But you get the feeling that there's more to it than just a couple of lemon zests being dropped in. That's what I got from it. It kind of feels citrusy, as you say, on the tongue or on the palate. And but you realize there's more to it than just that.
I love working with citrus peel as well. It's very I'd say that citrus is way more kind of would cut through much more to a greater extent than that, and it would lack the kind of, like you say, that the depth of the kind of rich, almost spice quality that it has, and it would change it from being probably from what I describe Acarus as like a spiced gin, but not a spicy gin. People hear peppercorn and they think heat, but there's not heat in there. It's like a general kind of spiced flavor to it.
Yeah, it's more like a warmth and as you say, earthiness, which it's not a burning sensation at all, right?
Yeah. When you distill with citrus, it's much more of a bright, fresh, very kind of lifting kind of citrus note you get, which is fantastic as well. It's probably, from my perspective, I think more suited to kind of a benchmark kind of London dry. And I think that's something I would always think of when you're talking about a kind of classic London dry, would be to focus on a citrusy note of that kind of classic peel quality, because I think that works way better in that role than like a Szechuan peppercorn would. But for this gin, I think it's the path that the kind of all the ingredients go down is to something a bit more, I don't know, I always use the word rich just because it's that kind of like, it's very kind of, it's not a light gin. It's a very kind of, I think I always say that it works very well with a Negroni, because in a Negroni, you're always fighting against two massive flavors in the other two ingredients in terms of your Campari, and which has got a huge bitter note, and then you've also got your sweet vermouth, which is incredibly sweet, as the name suggests. But you need a gin that can kind of bring its own character and its heft to the, almost to the drink, and give it a bit of and kind of fight through the other two to let you still get that flavor. So I think with that kind of that richness, it does carry through, and you do get a little bit of a fennel tickle, and you do get a little bit of a that woody floral character from the Szechuan peppercorn as well. So I think it's a big drink you need to have a gin to stand up in, and I think that's where this gin kind of shines, I think, is in that drink.
Absolutely. I tried it in a Negroni as well, and it does a fabulous job, because it as you say, this richness or depth that it has in certain areas can actually it actually does not get lost. Sometimes the citrus part, as you mentioned, kind of gets in a gin, can be kind of volatile to some extent, and it kind of gets lost quite quickly. I mean, I leave gins sitting for a couple of minutes, and actually even for an hour sometimes. I mean, I cover up the glass, but just to see what happens when it oxidizes over time, and sometimes even leave it overnight and see what remains the next day. And citrus very often just disappears super quickly. And with this one here, I've got a glass here, which I actually poured like 90 minutes ago. So, and it's been sitting here in the open and still has that intense citrusy twist to it. So that's actually very good. It's I actually made the Negroni because let's say a couple of years ago, I probably wouldn't have put it in a Negroni, because I might have simply not known that that will work so well. But I had a gin which maybe you know that's the batch 2 of the East London Liquor Company, for example, which is
definitely.
By itself is a gin I just took it for a gin and tonic and thought like, yeah, well, it's special, but it's not kind of my thing. And then actually visited them and was there at the bar, and they made their Negroni with the batch 2, and that's when I understood, all right, okay, this is your Negroni gin. And that's actually why I picked this up and made a Negroni right away, because I thought it's not identical, but it kind of has certain qualities which the batch 2 has as well. Probably it's the fennel which makes it work so well in the Negroni, plus the pepper, as we said, right?
Yeah, I think the idea of having specific gins that work specifically with particular cocktails is probably not something new, but it's and certainly the guys at Four Pillars, their Negroni gin is exactly that. It's a gin that's been kind of custom designed to work beautifully in one particular cocktail. And I mean, it works their drinks as well. It's a lovely gin. But that thing of thinking that, okay, what are the characters of a spirit that you look for in that particular cocktail? And what things do you want? And it's all very personal, obviously, but with something like a Negroni, for me, that was very much in my head when I was making this gin, because that's the gin cocktail that for me is my favorite. And because it's my company, I can afford to be selfish like that and kind of pick the things that I want it to work with. So, with that, I think certain drinks will always have, certain cocktails will always have particular gins that they work well with. And I think it's better to try and be great with one than it is to be a kind of, like cover off everything kind of thing. It's like be okay in all of them. I think is kind of, there's plenty of gins, great benchmark gins that are out there. And the London Dry category is filled with fantastic examples of gin that are good across a range of different cocktails. But like I say, this one was a bit different, so I wanted to kind of perhaps focus more on one particular drink. Although I'm still, again, like I still like it in a martini, although it's probably a bit funky for some people in a martini just because of the flavor profile. But I think it's a martini leaves you nowhere to hide as a gin. It's very much kind of, especially the way that most people drink them, is kind of very much teetering towards drinking just neat gin that's been cooled down a little bit with a little bit of dilution. So yeah, I think that's a real way to kind of showcase if you really love a gin, to see it with all its faults as well, as another thing. But it's I love a martini as much as a Negroni, but I think my preference for my gin would be in a Negroni,
which it's good to have it in a Negroni, which is another very funny side note to, or actually a reference to the Acros then again, right? Having it in a Negroni, which is so vibrant in color.
Yeah, and so that's the thing, is like it's a great combination of the two when you've got them sitting beside each other on a bar. I think last year there's a great bar in Edinburgh called the Bon Vivant, and we did a little thing for Negroni. It was a Negroni week. Negroni's got a whole week. It's when people have we have World Gin Day and now International Scottish Gin Day as well. Negroni's get an entire week to themselves, which I think is entirely fair. But yeah, the taking the photos on the bar for that, it's great. So you've got this big bright bottle and then this drink that's got, it's almost like a ruby, I think, is the coloring of a Negroni. It's fantastic. It's beautiful to take a photo of. And actually, last night I was literally just out. Scotland's just opened up a little bit more, so bars opened last night, so you could actually go and sit in them for the first time since lockdown began. And I went in and sat down and was kind of like, "Well, what would you like to drink?" And I was like, "I want a Negroni." It's a drink I can make at home, obviously, because it's one of the good things about having that kind of such a simple drink, three ingredients and some good ice. But like going and sitting in a bar with a little bowl of almonds and a Negroni is just, I was just like, oh, I'm back. This feels good. And yeah, it's just that beautiful, vibrant drink and that color you get in it is just incredible.
Perfect. Let's quickly maybe take a look at, we talked about the botanicals and you're on the larger still now. It's 500 liters, you said, I think.
Yes, that's right.
And so it's a London gin or a London dry gin. So basically you macerate the botanicals up front and mm-hmm. then it's being distilled in one go. For those yep. listening, not so it can be a London dry even though it's from Leith. one of the biggest misperceptions.
Leith dry.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything in terms of the distillation? You talked about the scaling and how the fennel seed behaves. Is there and as you said, you can come up with a multitude of recipes only by changing ratios of these botanicals already. Is there something I've read that you've done like special editions for like festivals and so on. Is that something that you're still doing, or is the main focus on the probably the main focus is still on your product, but is that something that is that you're doing right now, and or is something in the pipeline you would like to kind of hint at already, or or you can just remain silent for the moment?
I have nothing to say. No, I think so a lot of things to kind of go through. The distillation process for the gin is actually very, relatively speaking, a very straightforward production process. And it starts with, like I said, 7 botanicals, and they're all dry botanicals. So that's very straightforward. And basically they all go into the pot, we macerate in the still. Basically 2 days before distillation, I'll charge the still with organic neutral spirit and some good old Edinburgh water, and bring that ABV down to about 60%. And then it will sit and macerate, tuck the botanicals in, and it will sit for 2 days. And that just allows the interaction between the botanicals and the spirit. It helps to break down the structure of some of the tougher ones, like juniper is like, if you've ever held hard juniper berries, they're if you squeeze them and crush them, you get this huge release of the kind of sticky oils from the inside. And you can break them up in advance a little bit. I don't do that with this recipe for a number of reasons, but the if you leave them in the spirit, they just kind of soften up a bit. So when you turn on the still on day three, effectively, the heat then has kind of less work to do in terms of breaking them down and releasing these oils. Yeah, and it's the still we use is from a Polish company called Genio, and they're quite common in Britain amongst kind of smaller distillers. Like I say, it's 500 liters, which is a fair, like as the industry goes, kind of it's about the size of still that a kind of producer of my size would tend to work on. Just it's, it allows you to do a decent single size batch, and that batch will probably yield about 600 odd bottles, and we tend to do effectively a kind of process of similar to the whiskey kind of process of a Solera system. In terms of, it's rare that I ever just bottle a single batch. I usually marry it back into some of the previous batch. And that just helps to improve consistency between different batches of gin. Just from slight variations in terms of things like if it's a cold day, the still will be on for longer. So the heating will be on for longer and the botanicals be subject to heat for more. So it's little things like that. It will change little fluctuations in the kind of the flavor profile. And as a as a distiller, your kind of aim is to just make sure your product is consistent as possible, and that just helps a little bit. But yeah, the still is on basically. I'll be in on a distilling day. I'll probably start at 7 a.m. So it's a good early start. And the distillation run will probably run through till 5:30, and that'll be the production process, and then basically then dilute down to bottling strength at 41%. So that's 41 is just from playing around with the ABs of the hearts. Once you dilute them down, different things, kind of different flavor profiles result from changing the ABV, in the same way that if you add more or less tonic, your gin and tonic gets different. But as the actual distillation side of things, 41% was basically hit on from taking a few different examples to bartender friends and sort of saying like, which of these do you think works better as a finished product? And we all kind of came to the conclusion that 41% was the sweet spot for this particular recipe. So that's the production process for that. I mean, the other gins that I've done have been very different variations on the recipe. So I've worked some that are more herbaceous in terms of, I've done one with rosemary and thyme, which was really interesting in terms of I mean, rosemary is a tough herb, like it can survive being distilled in the pot, whereas thyme is perhaps a little bit more delicate. So the real concern there is getting horrible kind of green cooked vegetable flavors in, but they both yielded really, really lovely flavors together. So that worked quite well. That was for a pal of mine who was doing a festival event effectively and wanted a custom gin. And I've done other things with another festival in Scotland called Northop, and we did a custom gin for that. And also I've worked with a pal of mine, Joe Radford, who is kind of the drinks guru of Timberyard Restaurant in Edinburgh, who have like an absolutely incredible selection of drinks from all the way through from wine to like really interesting beers through to really interesting spirits. I mean, he was kind of one of the first people that I knew that was talking about Empirical over in Copenhagen. So tasting their spirits and things there was really interesting. But we were doing little funky projects with, he'd come to me with like he'd grab a plant and he'd be like, could we distill this? It smells amazing. And I'd kind of be like, sure, I'll look up, make sure it's not going to kill anyone because it's filled with some sort of weird toxin or whatever. And we did some really interesting kind of little single botanical distillations, but on I've got a little 4-liter rotary evaporator. So a little, basically vacuum still, which allows you to work at a much lower temperature and get really delicate flavors out of really kind of more fragile ingredients that would be wrecked if you use them in a traditional still. And yeah, we did things like lemon verbena, which is this beautiful citrusy herb, and the flavor from that, it was incredible. It was just this huge hit of super sweet lemon drops and also this really lovely kind of herbal note behind it all as well. And then we did things that perhaps didn't work as well. So I don't know what it's called in Germany, but there's a plant called the gorsebush, and you get them on they're big spiky bushes with yellow flowers, and here they're known as firs or gorse, and it's their flowers smell of coconut. A really, really intense kind of, on a sunny day, if you stick your nose in them, it's very, very coconutty. And we tried distilling that, but the problem then is that it's still very, very, very delicate, and even very delicate distillation process, it's still just completely trashed the aroma of it. So it just, sometimes these things work, sometimes they don't. I mean, part of the fun of it all is trying out whether the flavors do happen in the finished distillate, and you don't know until you've tried it. You can read up on all the chemistry and all the boiling points of specific compounds that have this aroma, and then you put them through the still and it just doesn't happen. So that's the kind of the more fun, interesting side of the production. And from my perspective, yeah, the next steps forward are what other spirits, electric could produce. So yeah, there's definitely going to be another gin. I have a kind of pretty clear idea in my head what that gin is going to be, and it's kind of learnings from things that I've tried out in the past that I like flavors with, and I think will work well together. And then subsequently as well, kind of, well, if it's not, what could I be producing that isn't gin? And I don't know if this is because I'm sharing a production space with a team that's building a whiskey distillery. But yeah, I don't think I'm aiming for a whiskey distillery. I'll say that much, but I think there's plenty of other interesting products within the distilled spirits world that I could have a pop at that would be quite interesting. So yeah, I think I'm a big fan of Aquavit as well, from which is obviously a spirit that's much more popular kind of Northern Europe than it is in any kind of around Scotland or Germany. But yeah, it's got tremendous kind of interesting flavor, tremendously interesting flavor profile, and it's very similar in theory to gin, except it's just got a different dominant kind of botanical instead. So yeah, I think playing around,
which is not too far away from yours, right? I mean, basically,
yeah, exactly.
You've got the fennel and aniseed part in it, so
yeah, caraways. I always find caraway quite a lot like almost smokier in flavor, I think is the kind of, I would say, the biggest difference between that and fennel. And I think it's one of these ones that I love the flavor because of food, in the same way that I love fennel because I love cooking with it. It's with caraway, it's that when I've had like a salt beef or a Reuben sandwich, and you get that rye bread with the caraway seeds on the top, and you just get those little bursts from the caraway seeds when you bite into them, and they've just got this really distinctive like sweetness, and then yeah, this kind of almost nutty, woody kind of smoky character to them as well. So it's, yeah, they're an interesting little flavor, and I think the caraway side of things is as a dominant flavor in a spirit is quite an interesting route to take. But I think the thing that in my experience a really good aquavit does well is that it's not just that one flavor. I think it's got a huge kind of, I've had beautiful aquavits, and like there's one from a company called Barrackston Gin. Barrackston, they're a distillery and they make a bunch of different things, and their aquavit is delicious. And it's really complex in a way that I've experienced with the sort of traditional ones that you see floating around, like I think it's Ligna is the one of the big brands, which is much more kind of, that's a classic aquavit, and it's very much quite focused on that one particular flavor. But I think there's, with an aquavit, there's a huge kind of range of complexity that you can have, and it's good that you can kind of play around with it in the same way as a gin, or a similar way anyway.
Sounds exciting. So you won't be bored within the next couple of days, weeks, and probably even years with yeah, so much experimentation.
At the moment, actually, I mean, we're talking and I've the big thing for me at the moment is literally just starting to export to Germany is my first export market in the world. So yeah, and again, it's come about as a result of the this relationship that I have with the Port Elise Distillery, who've really been hugely helpful in making it this kind of come to be, and introducing me to their partners that they work with in Germany to bring in their gin as well. So yeah, it's very exciting to sell to a completely different country and finding out about the kind of the German kind of enthusiasm for gin. And my little brother lives in Cologne, so I'm looking forward to kind of exploiting the opportunity to come out for work and go and see, catch up with my brother. So, but yeah, he's helping me with my translation, because my German at the moment is terrible, but hopefully that will improve.
Luckily, Germans have started to pick up the idea of learning English, and I think it's probably not due to better school efforts, but probably more to TV shows being available on streaming services in sometimes not German language, but
As we've talked about before, I'm not too enthusiastic about coming to Germany and making it known that I'm British at the moment. So I think if I can slip under the radar or just make it very clear that I'm a Scotsman, then I'd be much happier.
Yeah, I think that even if you don't, it's probably more, pity that people might feel
fair. That's absolutely fair.
Let's not resurrect the B word and hopefully get over with the C word now.
Let's keep it on happy things.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think kind of like looking at the average commuter times and the length of our recording here, it's probably a good idea to kind of
make this
a wrap. Exactly. And first of all, thank you for sharing all these insights and giving us an idea of what's behind the bottle, what's inside the bottle in more detail, and for actually taking the time to wade through my setup disaster here at first, which hopefully nobody could hear now, but
I think by this point everyone's used to a Zoom call that doesn't quite go to plan. It's been the last kind of 3 months in a nutshell, is just sort of staring at a screen where you can see someone's lips moving and nothing else happening.
Actually the connection was fairly good, and we only had very, very, very few dropouts, and that's all good. I think the what is worth mentioning is that the bottle, if you are in Germany, you're selling in the UK, obviously. In Germany, selling through Bottle Rocket. So bottlerocket.de, I'll put that in the show notes. Are there any other outlets, like is there Masters of Malt or something like that, which might be a thing which is another outlet which is makes it available internationally, or is it
So I think there's a couple that are good. You mentioned Master of Malt. There's also one of my very local wholesale partners in Edinburgh, Royal Mile Whiskies. They ship internationally. They're very, very good and experienced about shipping around the world. So I always recommend them. I'm still picking up who's buying the gin in Germany. And I found that there's a bar called the House of Gin in Berlin, who are, I think, one of the first stockists to have it behind the bar in Berlin. They tagged me in a Instagram story the other day. So I think it's fair to give them a plug as one of the first people to take a punt on the gin to put it on their bar. So yeah, you can, if you want to try a gin and tonic or a Negroni before you buy a bottle, then I'd say pop in there if you're nearby. But yeah, there's a fair few people that are stocking it around, getting around the place. But actually, yeah, it's just the beauty of how bad our duty rates on spirits are in the UK, that it's you're better buying it in Germany than you are buying it in Britain, just because it's such a good deal over where you are.
Yeah, in terms of spirits prices, we are kind of I don't know. It feels as if there's no tax on it at all, but it's being made somewhere else, I guess. We'll see.
Yeah.
But great. So there are a few places where one could try it, and I'm pretty sure whenever a bar stocks it or a shop has it, people will notice that it's on the shelf, because it will vibrantly announce itself
it'll shout at you across the bar.
Exactly. Hello, it's me, and the things next to me are not present.
that's hopefully the aim.
Mission accomplished. Great. Well, wonderful. Thanks for your time again, James, and
no problem.
I think we'll hear more in the future. And thanks for giving us a little insight into your process and how things have basically come to light, and your basically how you came to making this gin. I think this is great to actually not just see bottles and maybe try them, but actually know a little bit more about what's been going on. And one question that I would kind of have here is whether there's someone you might recommend I should interview, and if you can think of someone right now, that's fine. If you want to do that later, that's fine as well. But I'll just ask the question. Maybe that's a way of passing on the baton, basically.
Well, I guess I don't know if the obvious one would be to say speak to the guys at the Port Relief, because then you can fact check everything I've said. I think speak to those guys, because they've got a fascinating story about not just their gin and how they're how well they're doing as a company, but also in terms of their plans for making this beautiful whiskey distillery as well, because it's a great story to bringing kind of serious distilling back to Leith in such a spectacular way. They'd be a good shout for having a chat with as well.
Great. Yeah, well, I'll do that. They actually have the announcement postcard of the podcast already, because I could pass it on, I think, in March in Berlin. I'll happily take that advice and get in touch with them to get an appointment set up. Wonderful. And not just for the fact checking.
Yeah, they'll just tell you everything I've said is it's all rubbish. He's a liar.
Exactly.
There'll be Ian's always keen to have a chat. So he'll be a good person to have a good chat to.
Perfect. Well, again, thank you very much for your time, and click on the red button again, and hope this was a fun show, and people got an insight into what the Electric Spirit Company is all about, and very soon they'll be able to see more on the website if they want to look something up. You said you're in the making renovation it's process.
It's taken a global pandemic for me to actually get my finger out and do the job properly. So yeah, very soon there'll be a very nice website, lots of information on it. But at the moment, just go on you can go on Facebook or Instagram and ask me anything, because I'm the only one that's doing anything on it. So you'll always get answered by me.
Okay, great. You're talking to the owner and maker and everything. Great. Wonderful. I'm a
D-boy.
Great. I'll link all of those in the show notes so people can see that. Can hit you up if they have any follow-up questions. Thank you very much, and take care, and we cannot wait to see the vibrant bottles showing up in more stores and bars so people can try them. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks for sticking around. I hope you liked all the insights about James, his gin, and the history. What a lovely first interview partner to kick off the show. Find all the links and details in the show notes on the podcast website, and for that you simply point your browser to gin.show. If you have feedback, I'd love to hear it. Either shoot me an email to studio@gin.show or get in touch via Instagram. The show is named The Fabulous Gin Show. There's even more in the next episodes, so consider subscribing in iTunes, Spotify, or Pocket Casts so you don't miss an episode. And in case you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and please do tell your friends about it. Oh, and one last thing. You make gin? You're working for a business related to gin? Let me know if you want to be on the show. There's always a seat reserved for you. That's it for today. Thanks for listening, everyone. And as I always say, cheers and gin zelabim.